WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven, the Wyand Cimbeli Group, and Bridgeport Hospital.
It's very exciting for us here this evening because Ann Leary is going to be interviewing Anna Quinlan this evening. Very, very fun for us. Ann Leary's The Good House is a New York Times and National best-selling novel. She is also the author of the memoir An Innocent Abroad and the novel Outtakes from a Marriage. And we are so pleased to have her here. And she, of course, is going to be interviewing Anna Quinlan. Anna Quinlan is an author and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction and nonfiction bestseller lists. While a columnist at the New York Times, she, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize. She is the author of a memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. You might have recalled we had her here last year. And two collections of essays, Living Out Loud, Thinking Out Loud, and six prior novels. And you guys all have such great memories of her, as I was talking to you earlier. So I'm going to welcome both of them right now. Come on out.
I love that we can't see any of you, so I'm not as nervous as I would have been. I'm Ann Leary, and this is Anna Quinlan. In case you didn't know, you probably did know that. I wanted to thank WSHU for inviting me to do this. I was so excited when I was asked. I'm a huge fan of Anna Quinlan and was really honored to be able to participate tonight. And also I'm excited that RJ Julia, one of my favorite bookstores, is part of this as well.
Yay.
So anyway, I wanted to just start out by, you know, again saying that I'm thrilled to be here on the stage with Anna Quinlan. And I think we should just start talking about the book, because I'm really excited about it. The novel is Still Life with Breadcrumbs, and I think I share with probably most of you. It's odd, I can't see any of you. There might be nobody out there. But I have a feeling I'm not the only person in this room who feels like they raised their family with Anna Quinlan. I am now an empty nester, and Still Life with Breadcrumbs is about an empty nester who actually had to kind of vacate the nest. And that was, I thought, was a really interesting setup. And anyway, I just didn't know. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about the book and where Rebecca, our heroine, is at the beginning of this novel?
Sure. Rebecca is a photographer who is very well known for a single photograph, which happens to be called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. It's one of those iconic images that comes along every once in a while. We can think of them, those men on the Italian street hooting at that beautiful dark-haired woman, or the iconic Vietnam photograph of the little girl running down the street after the napalm storm. And in her case, it's a single photograph that people have decided epitomizes the trap of domesticity. It's a photograph of her kitchen counter after a dinner party with a bottle of olive oil and a singed dish towel and the ends of a couple of baguettes. Rebecca is somewhat puzzled by this analysis of her work, but she's ridden it to a certain kind of notoriety and a good deal of money. When the novel begins, however, the money has run out. The notoriety is still there, but as people will tell you, you really can't pay the rent on notoriety. And she can't pay the rent at all at some level because she's taking care of her aging parents and trying to help out her son Ben a little bit. So she sublets her New York co-op and moves to a ramshackle little cabin in the middle of nowhere, where she's both hoping for fresh inspiration as a photographer and also to become solvent again.
Yeah, and you know, what I really loved, and I certainly will not give too much away, but I really, as I was reading this, I couldn't help but feel that this book, your other books have certainly explored kind of the blessings and joys of parenting and being a member of a family, but also the loneliness of that. And this, I really felt, you really explored kind of the loneliness of the author, and I couldn't help but feel that the career of Rebecca as a photographer in some ways might have, it felt like it might have paralleled your career as a writer a little bit. I wondered if you didn't draw from that, the sense of I felt that Rebecca felt sometimes misunderstood as a photographer. She was greatly successful and well received, but maybe not in the way she would have thought she would have been. Was that, am I right? Is that?
Well, I'm really interested in the nature of art and whether we trust our own senses or we wait for someone else to tell us what is good. Whether we wait for critics or sales or the public wheel to tell us that something is officially the next big thing. And I think when you sort of get shot out of the cannon of that, as I did at one point when I was doing a column for the New York Times called Life in the 30s, you know, and you're one little woman in a house trying to get two little boys out of diapers and not trip over the Legos, and then you wake up one morning and someone says you're the voice of a generation, you think, how the hell did that happen? And how come there's still no clean laundry, you know? There's this kind of disconnect between how the world sees you and what your life is really like. And that's really something that I wanted to explore deeply in this book. Because there is that phenomenon, particularly in a city like New York, where Rebecca will go to a party and everyone will make a huge fuss over her because of something she once was. Mm. And it makes it so much more difficult to say, but I haven't had a successful show in 10 years, and I'm not sure how I'm going to pay the maintenance on the apartment and that sort of thing. There's that disconnect between that big public persona that takes on a life of its own and what your real day-to-day life is like.
Right. And what I also loved about the novel was this sense of, you know, she's kind of in a middle place, or she's not sure if she's in a middle place or an end place in her career, but also in that strange middle place that in her family, where she's a mother and she's a daughter, but her son's grown up and her parents, they all seem to need her a little bit of help from her financially, but they don't seem to have their needs. They don't need her. The parents have caretakers or a partner, and the son is independent. And that really resonated with me. And her husband, her dastardly husband, is gone. Thank God. I loved hating Peter. So she's kind of afloat, and I think that really resonated with me, and I think with others that you know, this time in your life where you're what is next? If you're a person who has had found nurturing to be a joy and also, you know, difficult to have that gone, and I really felt that with Rebecca, that it was she was, you know, kind of you know, in this middle place, not sure. You know,
but that's so commonplace nowadays. And it's actually a middle place that didn't even exist, say, 40 or 50 years ago, because your parents wouldn't live long enough for you to have to support them financially, perhaps in a nursing home or, you know, underwriting their rent. And your kids in their 20s would be launched.
Right.
They would have homes and families of their own. I mean, you know, we always talk about the progression. When my parents were 25 years old, they were married and had two children.
Right.
When I was 25 years old, I was married. When my kids were 25 years old, they weren't even thinking about getting married. So there's this whole new way of being in the world. I feel like my generation of women, our generation of women, had to make a whole lot of stuff up. Yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't have any model for how do you hire somebody to help take care of your kids when you're at work. Mm. I didn't have any model for how do you make sure that you make as much money as your male counterparts, or how do you deal with being a woman in some sort of position of influence out in the world? And this is another thing that all of the women I know are making up as we go along. How much do you help support your adult children, either spiritually or financially? What is it you do for your parents, and how much of a toll does that take on you? And so she's very much a woman of her time in that she's not only trying to invent these new roles, She's trying to reinvent herself because, unlike women of generations past, at age 60, she has a quarter of her life in front of her. Mm-hmm. And she's got to figure out exactly what she's going to do with it.
Do you want to read a little excerpt of the book?
Sure. At the very beginning of the novel, Rebecca has moved into this cabin, which, as she says, she is horrified as a photographer she took on the basis of photographs. And the tip-off should have been most of the photographs were photographs of the view. As she says, you cannot take a shower in the view. You cannot cook in the view. There were no photographs of the bathroom or the kitchen, and there was a very good reason for that. And she has discovered that something is living in the attic crawl space. And a local roofer has come to help her with whatever it is. The roofer had returned at 8 a.m. She had already been up for hours. The roofer had looked as though he had to, but in a good way. Damp, fair hair like a cornfield with its comb tracks. T-shirt with a hint of fold marks and the smell of fabric softener. Dark green windbreaker with the words Bates Roofing in gold embroidery. He must have a good wife, Rebecca had thought, picturing a woman folding his T-shirts, smoothing them with her hand, handing him the windbreaker from a hook in the hall. The rented house reeked of smells Rebecca preferred not to parse too closely. And from time to time, there was a half-hearted clanking noise from above. She wondered if the raccoon would die of exertion. She hoped so. She had heard the staccato drumming of the truck engine climbing the hill, and she went out front, where the air was fresh and lovely, grass and flowers and a suggestion of wet soil. Why did the forest out back smell of rot and the sunny front lawn like the signature scent of springtime? A glint of light crossed her face from below like some mysterious signal, and she raised her hand to shade her eyes, and the roofer raised his to return what he clearly thought was a greeting. I don't even need to ask, the roofer had said when he got out of the truck, although she wasn't sure if he meant the circles under her eyes or the smell from the house. How on earth will you get that creature out of the attic? She said wearily. First the coon, then the cage, he said, and from the passenger seat of the car he took a long gun. You're going to shoot it? Unless you had another idea, he'd said. When I saw the trap, I assumed you would release it. He held the gun by the barrel. It was carved with a hunting scene, a man and a deer, both stiff and unconvincing, but made beautiful by the gloss of the wood and the faint blur to the figures and the finish that Rebecca thought meant the gun was old and well used. Grandfather, father, son, a family gun. Here's the thing about raccoons. They're creatures of habit. If you catch a coon and spray paint an X on his butt, then let him go, a week later you'll be catching the same coon. The X on his butt will be laughing at you. So, yeah, if you want, I can let him go. But unless I drive him to Maine, he'll be back and trying to find a way into your attic, and you'll be starting all over again. Rebecca closed her eyes. No, thank you, she said. Good decision, he said, opening the flimsy screen door. Sometimes I think city people wind up watching too many Disney films. They confuse real animals with cartoon animals. Can I take a look first, she asked, at the coon? I'm a photographer, she said. Be my guest. She'd climbed the ladder in the narrow hallway, thrust her head and shoulders through the hatch, and rested her elbows on the edge of the filthy attic floor. The cage was wedged into the corner over the kitchen, up against a pile of old screens and a cardboard box. The raccoon looked over its shoulder at her, its pinpoint eyes wild with fear and rage. It did look like a cartoon character. But a cartoon character in one of those avant-garde cartoons young artists were always making and Ben was always praising. Sven the Possessed Raccoon, it would be called. She thought she heard a hiss. An overhead bulb in the center of the triangular space cast deep shadows. The scent of waste and desperation was too much to take for long. She shot a few fast photographs as the coon hurtled toward her,
clinging to the bars of the cage and somersaulting as though he could spin free. He stopped not far from the hatch, and she shot a few more of his pointed face in close-up. "He ate the banana," she said after she came down the ladder. "I think that's a she," the roofer said. "A male raccoon is pretty mellow. He'd probably be half asleep right now. A female raccoon will tear you to pieces if you give her half a chance."
That was great. And I really loved the description of the sound the raccoon was making above her while she was trying to sleep. And it just was so, anyone, and we all, it's great because in Connecticut, if most of you live in Connecticut, we all know what it's like to have animals come in our house that don't belong there. And that, you know, when I was reading that, I was thinking, you know, when a mouse is in your wall, it sounds huge. And when a raccoon is in your roof, it sounds like, you know, a thundering herd of elephants. So, but you really got, you really nailed the city person coming out to what is supposed to be kind of a charming place and finding it terrifying. And so, Deb, you had that experience. Do you live in the city, and do you have a place in the country?
We do. We do have a place in the country. And full disclosure, we have had a raccoon.
I could tell you knew a lot.
A male raccoon and a female raccoon, which is how I know the difference. But I do think there's that sense that is particularly profound for her because she's a photographer. Of estrangement from the natural world. I mean, that's not what she's taken pictures of. Her first really well-known series was called the Kitchen Counter series, and it was these photographs of the kitchen counter. And then she did a series of pictures of her son's toys, you know, his robot toys and Transformers, which were also well-received. And then she took some pictures of him when he was sleeping and naked and a baby that were kind of, you know, geographic almost, but she hasn't connected with the natural world in that way. And that's something, that's one of the ways in which her universe expands during the course of the novel.
Right.
Which, by the way, is somebody in an interview last week used the word playful, and I almost hugged them because actually one of the things that I did with this book that I've never done before was that I had a sense of kind of ease and play and humor. I was telling someone when I was out front before, my last novel was a novel called Every Last One, which I'm very proud of, but was in many ways quite a dark book. And I think this was a response to it, that sense of wanting to be playful, of wanting to write a book that had a happy ending, which I've never really done before. And the other thing that someone said to me, because the great thing about going out on book tour and out into the world with a book is that readers tell you things about your own work that you either hadn't realized or only dimly. And someone said to me earlier today, well, you know, this is a coming-of-age story. Well, we usually think of a coming-of-age story as, you know, a young man who goes from 18 to 22 and is in the service or at college or the rest. But this really is a coming-of-age story. It's just a coming of a different age in the long life of a woman.
Right. But, you know, I see what you're saying. There is a very, almost a childlike, where she starts exploring in the woods. And it actually, the breadcrumb image reminded me of a nursery, of a fairy tale, Grimm's fairy tale. She's following a trail, which I won't put too much away, but she's following a trail in the woods, and she's really exploring nature in a really childlike kind of innocence of it, which I thought was really really believable and really really made you quite love her even more.
But she does something else, I think, that's really important, which is, you know, she thinks of herself as very sophisticated because she's a New Yorker. But in some ways, she's not sophisticated about the way the world really works. And one of the things that she discovers is that she's taken these photographs without really thinking about what's behind the photographs. And both in terms of the nature photographs that she winds up taking almost purely accidentally and begrudgingly, frankly, and the photographs she begins to take of these found objects, that she finds in the woods around her house. She's forced at a certain point to confront what things mean in three dimensions. You know, sometimes photographers take a picture of, well, I'll go back to that Vietnam War photograph. I remember at a certain point thinking, should the photographer have taken the picture, or should the photographer have stopped to throw his jacket on the little girl who was running on fire? And that's always a journalistic dilemma. Do you report the story because that will serve the greater good, or do you inject yourself into the story because that ought to be a kind of a basic human impulse? And I think for the first time in her professional career, she is forced to face the human impulse to not only take pictures of things, but to think of what they meant when they were placed there. And it's a really profound change for her to move essentially from living in two dimensions to living in three. Right. And I think that's something that going from the city to the country gives her.
But I also felt that also, again, going back from the photographer and the writer as artists, have you come across that as a writer where you accidentally maybe you didn't intend for a certain interpretation, or for example, in your essays and in your columns, did you worry about people being thinking you took them wrong or misunderstood? And I guess my next question from that, which you probably are asked every time you're interviewed, is do you prefer writing fiction to nonfiction so you don't have to worry about that kind of thing?
I mean. It's axiomatic that if you're a reporter or a columnist, there are going to be people who don't like what you write.
Right.
And there are going to be people who you've covered who say, she got it wrong. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that as a reporter, we often learn to discount that because so many people cry wolf.
Right.
So many people say she got it wrong because it's not as flattering as you wanted it
right.
to be, or she got it wrong because it didn't have the spin that you wanted on it. But you're constantly aware of the fact that people are going to say that. When you become a columnist, you have to be aware of that fact and you have to put it behind you. Mm-hmm. Because if you feel people looking over your shoulder and disapproving as a columnist, you will never write anything that has the heft and the confidence that an opinion column has to have, particularly when being written by a woman. Mm. Because we have a rich, full tradition, not only in this country but in the world throughout history, of saying men should have opinions and women should have aprons. And so when you get the opportunity to untie your apron and have opinions, boy, you'd better bring every bit of your confidence to bear. And that's what I tried to do when I was an opinion columnist. And I loved that job, and I loved being a reporter, and sometimes I miss the newsroom so much, but I find it much more challenging now to write fiction than to write essays, which, you know, I've been doing since my late 20s, so I'd better have it down by this time. And that's what keeps me writing fiction, that each new novel is a unique, terrifying opportunity.
Right. Interesting. So I also wanted to say, when you Google Anna Quindlen, not that I've ever done that, but I've heard that when you Google Anna Quindlen, anyone you Google, something will come up. It's the most searched thing. And it's like the second or third thing is Anna Quindlen quotes. And I think it's like you, Mark Twain, and like Benjamin Franklin of American. Like you have so many wonderful kind of aphorisms, wonderful quotes that probably, I think, do come from your columns and your book that you did. I think the book that was more your guide. What was the?
A Short Guide to a Happy Life.
Short Guide to a Happy Life and all your commencement speeches and stuff. But they're all so smart, fun, and clever, and on the ball. And there was actually a line in this book that I wrote down. because it's another one. And it was so, it just really made me think. And again, it's this theme of being a woman of a certain age. Anyway, this is I wrote, the problem was that, and this is Rebecca, about Rebecca. The problem was that she thought that at a certain point she would be a finished product. I thought that was so amazing. And leading up to it, you kind of wrote about how she, thought she was working towards this thing. And at some point, I think we all think, you know, I can't wait to see what I, you know, what all this is leading to. And then what she learns at 60 is it just is always evolving. And, or she's starting to learn maybe. I was really moved by that. I love that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. The weird thing about those quotes, because sometimes
you probably don't remember writing.
I mean, my brain is a sieve.
Yeah.
So I come upon this quote and it's attributed to me and I'm like, wow, that's really smart. And I can't remember ever writing it. And sometimes I check them. And it turns out I did write it at some point, but it's so long ago. And, you know, I have this thing called a Facebook fan page because I can't have, like, a real Facebook page because how lame would that be? But it's the Random House people sort of put it together and everything. And people leave really nice things on it. And a couple of weeks ago, I was getting ready to go out and I thought I looked really good, except that I looked down and realized that one of my socks was black and one was navy blue. And it reminded me of the fact that when I was writing Life in the 30s, I wrote a column called Putting Up a Good Front about how I always looked pretty good, but like my hem was held up with masking tape or I was wearing boots because I couldn't find socks or things like that. And
None of us can relate to that.
I reposted that a link to that column, which I wrote in 1986 or 7, on the Facebook fan page. And all these people wrote these nice comments. Oh, I remember this column so well. And I thought, you do? I can't even remember my cell phone number.
I love it.
It is the hard thing about writing a novel that we were talking about backstage, which is you're so in the thicket of this thing. It's not even like you can't see the forest for the trees. You can't see the trees. Mm. By the time you're done with it, someone could say to you, oh, you know, you gave the sun 3 different names during the course of the novel, and you'd be like, hey, I have a draft done.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And the great thing about having an editor that you love and trust is that she'll say to you, you know, I just wonder why when she encounters these tableaus in the woods, she doesn't wonder who's leaving them. And you sort of hit yourself in the head and think, of course. But because you become so close to the material while you're working on it, you're really living in it. You sort of lose perspective in all kinds of ways. Didn't you find
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, you are in a very lonely, as a writer, you are so lonely. And I don't show anything I'm working on until it's finished. I don't show parts of books because only really, like my husband will read it once and then he'll pretend to read it. He's not going to read it draft after draft, or any of my friends. So you're in this kind of vacuum, and then by the time the editor sees it, yeah, it's true. You don't see the forest for the trees. You don't see that you've made major, you know, kind of mistakes. And, you know, one person stays the same age for many years and the other person is progressing with their life. But
you have nothing to talk about at dinner parties. So all around you, people are like, oh, I performed orthopedic surgery, and I adjudicated a case, and I did a big deal. And you're like, oh, I had Rebecca go to tea for two and have breakfast. And everybody's like, who's Rebecca? And you're like, never mind. In about 3 years, she'll find out.
Now, what do you say when people ask, what's your book about? If you're working on a book and you're at a dinner party and people do that, well, tell me what your book is about. Do you or do you just, because I always tend to say, oh, it's just a stupid nothing. I can't, because I don't like to tell that.
I say it's about 200.
I never can make it sound good. So
I say it's about 250 pages.
Oh, you do?
I mean, you know, you can't answer that question. First of all, because when you're working on it,
you don't really know.
You're not really sure what it's about. I mean, you know, you think you have some general ideas of themes, but it's really not until it's kind of a done object that you think, oh my gosh,
this is really a is really a coming of age book. And plot is so reductive. Mm. I mean, if you just recite the plot,
it sounds ridiculous.
She's married and she has a kid and she falls in love with a guy named Vronsky and she throws herself in front of a train. You know, that's Anna Karenina.
Right. Which brings us to flap copy and why it's so dreaded. It's the hardest thing to write or read is your flap copy, because I actually don't, if I'm going to buy a book, I never read the flap copy because I want to see if the writing is compelling or I'm not going to be interested in reading it. But you know, the flap copy is the information on the inside cover of the book that tells you what the book's about. And it's just so hard for me anyway to see your book reduced to this kind of little explanation that isn't that compelling, I don't think, usually.
But also it's kind of mortifying, too, because it's always in this brilliant, resonant account of, and you're like, okay.
You think it's like you're setting up expectations too high.
Yeah, and then you're like, don't put spoilers in there and so on and so forth. So it doesn't really give you anything to talk about at dinner parties. And the other thing that's kind of weird, if you're doing it right, is frankly the people in these books become much more real to you than anybody in your real life. So that, you're sitting at the dinner table and you're thinking, but did Rebecca really like the Kitchen Counter series, or did she just like it because it became famous? And meanwhile, real life is eddying around you and you're stuck
in
this
cabin. Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I found that, for example, the book I'm working on right now, I realized it was going to be a book when I couldn't wait to see what was going to happen to these people. You know, and I think that I actually was wondering, do you actually create characters and settings and then the plot evolves from that? Or do you actually think of a plot are you more of a plot driven author?
No. Yeah. I'm not plot driven at all. In fact, my first novel, Object Lessons, I handed in to my editor, Kate Medina, and she said, the writing, who by the way has been my editor on all my books, and she said, the writing is so beautiful and the characters are so well drawn, but nothing really happens.
Right.
And
yes,
I said,
but they're great.
And I said, well, that's what life is like. Nothing really happens. And she said, and that's why we call this a novel. I really kicked it the traces. I'm very character driven.
Yeah.
And before I write a single word, I've spent months thinking about a character. I mean, by the time I finally sat down, I knew a lot about Rebecca Winter.
Right.
I knew that she was an only child. I knew that she was Jewish. I knew that she'd grown up on the west side of Manhattan. I knew, of course, that she was a photographer and that she was divorced. It's really that central character that is the nucleus. And then as I begin to think about the situation she might find herself in and how she might deal with that and the people she might meet as she deals with that, I start to imagine scenes and dialogue. And when enough is going on in my head and I feel a little bit like a crazy person, that's when I finally start to write.
Right. But so I think you get to the point where you know the character Rebecca well enough that there's no, that helps you with the plot, because there's no scene you can't imagine. You know how she would react. If Rebecca had to go to the moon, you know how Rebecca would behave on the
right
moon, for example.
Right.
And so it really helps, I think, with plot, because I feel like that's my stronger point is character. And then the plot, and that's why my one memoir, that's the one thing I did like about writing it, was I knew the story. It was, and I knew the beginning, middle, and end.
I don't know about you, but I always know the beginning. By the time I sit down, I've been thinking about this for so long that the first chapter is almost transcription.
Uh-huh.
And the great thing about it is I finish the first chapter and I look it over and I'm like, oh, I'm a genius. This is going to be so good, And then you get 100 pages and you're like, oh, I've wasted my life. No one's going to read this. But I almost always know the beginning, and I almost always know the end, so that the great challenge is the middle. And it's
right.
Almost always the part of the book that I have to rewrite
most conspicuously when I'm doing my revisions.
So I know the audience probably wants to ask questions, but now I just have to ask, like, writer questions that I'm hopefully you will all be interested in too. So do you edit as you go along? Do you, when you sit down, what's your process like? Do you write every morning, every day?
Well, when you're, I'm not always asked that question on book tour when I'm not writing at all.
Right.
But most days I write between about 9:30 and 2:30 or 3 o'clock, something like that. And some days I really hammer it out for a couple of hours, and some days I'm just sort of noodling around,
right,
and nothing's. But I'm actually, I think that there are two different kinds of writers, and it so happens that I have two sons, each of which epitomizes one kind. The one kind is the one who writes and then goes back over it and can't really move forward, uh-huh, until what they've already done is exactly the way they want it. I am not that kind of writer. My second son and I are what we call run like hell to the end writers, uh-huh, which is both of us work on a novel, we barely look back, we really pound it out till the end, and we figure then we'll go back and fix the mess. It's the only way that our motto is, don't get it right, get it written.
Interesting.
And that really works for us. My older son is much more of a got to get it right as I'm working on it. And I hope that means that he won't have to do as much revision as Christopher and I habitually have to do.
Right. Yeah, so when you sit down, you don't look at yesterday's work? You just plow on?
I sort of very briefly look at yesterday's work, but I don't spend a lot of time noodling around with it.
That's great.
I tend to be a plower oner.
Interesting. All right. Well, did we want to open it up for questions? Okay.
My question was, you said that writing is terrifying, and I just wondered personally how you muster the courage to keep going when you are filled with self-doubt. Or maybe you're not.
No, I really hate to write. I mean, if I had a choice between writing and watching Sherlock on the DVR, there's no question which one would win. The mantra is butt in chair. And that's what I do every day. I sit down and I start to string words together because that's what I do. And one of the reasons I do it is because there are days when you start to write sentences and then you start to type faster and faster still, and you look up and 2 hours have gone by. And you've been completely in it and you've gotten it right and you know it and you can feel it. And it doesn't happen every day and it doesn't happen often enough. But the reason that you sit down and start is because it just might happen. And I think that's really what keeps you going. That memory of those days. I wrote what I was worried was going to be the most challenging chapter in my last novel, Every Last One. I spent like 2 or 3 days wandering around saying, well, now I've got to write this chapter. And Christopher was out in the country working with me. He was working on his book while I was working on mine. He said, Mom, go up right now and just do it. And I went up, and I was 2 sentences into it, and I went into a fugue state. And I finished the entire chapter, which was an incredibly painful, draining, linchpin chapter about halfway through the book. And I finished, and I thought, that is exactly right. And when my editor was editing the book, she wrote in the margin, nothing in this chapter. And you live for those rare moments when that happens. And that's why you put butt in chair. Anyone else?
Any other questions?
Oh, come on. What is this, middle school?
Here comes somebody. But just as she's approaching, I will say that the butt in chair thing, I think a lot of younger writers that I've met have this idea that a muse, you wander around and wait for this kind of muse to strike, and then you sit down. But it's not going to happen unless
Madeline Longla, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time, for which she should be thanked forevermore into perpetuity, once said, inspiration comes during writing, not before it. And it's a really important thing to remember. I don't know where the muse is at Toni Morrison's house, but she ain't at mine.
I've been following your writing for years, and I can remember in the 1980s reading your column in the New York Times and just being blown away. I just loved it. One of the things that I took away from it, and please, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, was there's what resonated for me was your growing up Catholic. And I just wonder how you weave that, or if that is a part of your writing and how that figures into this novel, your sort of development with your own, you know, looking back on how that influenced you or how that affects you now.
It's not a big part of this novel, although there's an iconography of the work that she winds up doing out in the country that clearly has Catholic resonance. It was a big part of my last book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, which had a whole chapter about faith. But in that way that people will say, you know, well, how much of you is in Rebecca Winter? Well, all of me is in Rebecca Winter at the same time that she's not very much like me, because you bring who you are to everything that you write. And I bring being Catholic not only to everything I write, but to everything I do. It's so funny that I'm going to say this. I'm on the National Board of Planned Parenthood, and I'm chair of the Development Committee, which means I raise money for the organization. And I raise money for Planned Parenthood because I'm a Catholic, and because the New Testament says that if you have two cloaks, you should give one to the man who has none. And so every time I can get some money to support one of our programs, I think, well, there's a cloak changing hands. I'm a big fan of income redistribution.
Hi. For me, this is like a very big moment. If I had a bucket list, just to speak to you or to be here tonight would be on my bucket list.
Oh, man, you're killing me.
A Short Guide to a Happy Life had a very profound effect on me. I have honestly given the book probably 50 times. And I just wonder if you realize the effect you have had, what your gifts have done for so many of us.
I do, because of people like you who have said things like that. But here's the really important thing for me to say. Writing is transactional. So it's not like I write things and I give them to you. It's like you read them and you give something to me. And that's this profound sense of being heard, which is so unusual in our society, and which can mean so much to a woman who spends most of her time sitting by herself in a little room looking at a blank computer screen. So every time someone like you does this, it makes me feel as though on the other side of that computer screen, there's another person, and that I'm not just putting words on a page. We're having a dialogue. And to the extent that reading, the great joy of reading is that it makes us feel less alone in the world, writing makes you feel less alone ultimately because you imagine readers. And thank you for not only allowing me to imagine them, but allowing me to see one of them.
Aww. Thank you.
I'm curious to know, maybe this is a corollary to butt and chair, but how you both not only force yourself to write, but both get past the inner critic, but also have enough of it to improve in your writing, and you know, what you think the most fundamental experiences have been over the arc of your career to really make you continue evolving and becoming an even better writer?
The inner critic is really interesting. She's kind of like Jiminy Cricket on your shoulder. So, you know, you're working on the sentence and you're blah, 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 blah. And the inner critic says, whoa, that sentence is long. And you ignore the inner critic and you keep on going. And then I always read my work aloud before I hand it in. I wish I could do the audiobook and the read aloud at the same time and kill two birds. But when you read aloud a really long sentence, you can't breathe at the end. And then you have to listen to the inner critic. But at a certain point, the two of you are indivisible. And here's what I think is a really important thing. And to some extent, it's reflected in this book and Rebecca's life. You put a book out there and there's going to be critics writing about it. And there's going to be readers opining on Amazon and BNN.com about it. And there's going to be friends who are talking about it when you're not in the room. And if you listen to those voices, it will make your work less good because it will make it less brave, less audacious. So once I finish reading over the final draft of a novel, I have a very specific conscious moment where I say, Anna, this is good work. And I try to embed that in my brain so that all of the voices of the world that come after will lose their power over me. And they don't always entirely lose their power, although I don't read reviews of my books anymore. They don't entirely lose their power, but they're blunted by the fact that I've made this deal with myself. And that's when the inner critic is most valuable, when it can say, this is what you meant to do, and this is good.
Is somebody else coming up?
I haven't met Rebecca yet, but our book club recently read Black and Blue. And I remember reading that you said that you felt that you knew Franny very well, and every once in a while you felt that you could see her on the street. I find in your books that all of you women are very brave. They find an inner strength somewhere. And I know your background. I know the personal loss you had when your mother died and you were quite young. Do you think that had something to do with the brave women who find their inner strength in your novels?
Undoubtedly. I mean, there's no question that that's been a huge influence on my life. But I have to say, I think I write deeply realistic novels, and I think that they are populated with brave women because the world is populated with brave women.
And that will be in the quotes, the many quotes. But that is another thing I loved about this novel is that, and your other novels, is that, you know, the people aren't extraordinarily glamorous or, you know, extraordinarily, you know, certainly she's a renowned photographer, but it's actually the quiet, kind of noble hero of Jim Bates, the man she meets, who is quite somebody that many people know, a guy like this, and he is a hero, but not, but in a real way that, and I think that's what works for me.
Well, and I think the world is populated by a lot of good men, and you know, after I wrote Black and Blue, which has at its center a very, very complicated guy named Bobby Benedetto, who in the Ways account is a bad man because he beats and terrorizes his wife, I suddenly thought that what I wanted to reflect in the book were the good, nurturing men that I knew. And that's why in Blessings, the protagonist is a woman in her 80s and a young guy named Skip Cuddy who comes to work as a handyman on her property. And similarly with this book, there's a certain kind of guy who just does the right thing as a matter of course. It's reflexive with him. And that's what Jim Bates is like. In some ways, he's an old-fashioned kind of guy. I mean, witness the fact that he still makes a grilled cheese sandwich with 4 tablespoons of butter and a loaf of Wonder Bread. But he's also a guy who is... I mean, Rebecca's always saying about her work, "I know it when I see it." When you look at him, you know it when you see it.
He's a solid guy.
Hi. So I'm probably among a number of aspiring writers who are here. And I'm wondering what your opinion would be of partaking in writers' conferences and writers' workshops, which I've done over the years with a couple of my colleagues that are here with me this evening. And since you've discussed button chair, which I've heard on a number of occasions during these workshops and so forth, and tried to do just that, what is your opinion of the process that one goes through in becoming more than just an aspiring writer? What do you think the value of the workshops are as opposed to simply sitting there, using your guts, using your audacity, I love that word that you used, your inner talents, your abilities, and just banging it out and not just sharing it, but just doing it? What is your feeling there?
I had a creative writing concentration at Barnard where I went to college, and which has turned out a disproportionately large number of female writers over the years. And in my senior year, our teacher was a writer named Joy Shute. And when we came in on the first day, she held up a manila envelope. And she said, "You are all to go out and buy a box of these." And we couldn't figure out why. And then she made it clear to us that she expected us to send our work out. It was the most revolutionary idea that I had ever heard, because during all of my other creative writing seminars, we had read, commented on one another's work. And I think that that was really useful. Although, given the fact that we tended to be very smart and very ambitious, there was a fair amount of snark involved from time to time. But I think what she was saying to us was it was time to graduate from talking about our work to sending our work out into the world. That's a really hard thing. Many people send their novels out into the slush piles of American publishing, never to be seen or heard of again. But there are books that are chosen and published, sent in over the transom. And I think the danger with getting too invested in writers' groups or conferences is that that can sometimes become an end in itself. And the end is to find a larger universe of readers. And the only way that you can do that is to send your work out into the world.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
I had a couple of questions. First of all, since you've been writing fiction, do you tend to read more fiction now?
I've been a fiction reader all my life. It's much more of a challenge for me to make myself read nonfiction, although obviously, you know, the best of the bunch always grabs me. I mean, you know, I could barely sleep for reading Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Katherine Boo, which is as good a piece of narrative nonfiction as has been published in this country in many years, or Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. I'm overwhelmingly a fiction reader and always have been.
And also, what kinds of things do you have at your writing desk?
I have a MacBook Pro. Right now I have my old one because last week I spilled a half a glass of Pellegrino onto the keyboard of my new one, and it made a funny noise, and then it died. And it cannot be resuscitated, which was quite traumatic, although I didn't lose any content because I have a good backup program. And then I have a large array of nun paraphernalia, which has been given to me by my second son, who has a very puckish sense of humor. I have rubber nuns. I have nun snow globes. I have whack-a-nun. I have a little nun headdress, but it's too small for me. And above my desk, I have the original of a Brenda Starr strip from the 90s, which has my name in it, which was kind of the zenith of my existence. But stuck on the edge of that framed Brenda Starr strip is a Post-it that is one of my most important talismans. It says, "Say no." And it reminds me not to say yes to everything, because if I do, I get overextended and I don't have enough writing time. So that's sort of the lay of the land at my writing desk.
Hi, I want to say that because of you, I read magazines starting at the back so that I can always
That's what we call the Hebrew approach.
So I could always read the last word first, and always enjoyed your Newsweek columns and how it encouraged women to find themselves and also to make them aware that they were probably most better than they thought they were and could do more than they thought they could. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any closing words you would like to share with us?
Gosh.
Are you working on another book? What are you?
I am. I'm working on a new novel, but I sort of had to put it to bed last week in the face of
the tour.
Of book tour and sort of go out there and do it. But I must say, someone asked me tonight if book tour is onerous, and the truth is it is in some ways because of the travel and, you know, the difference between taking a plane now and taking one, say, 25 years ago, which is when I did my first book tour, when I was pregnant with Maria. All the media escorts all over the country had the names of the level one neonatal ICU in their city, which was both soothing and terrifying.
Right.
But the great thing about going on book tour is getting to meet actual readers. It makes me understand why my favorite writer, Charles Dickens, used to go out and do these public readings of his work where he played all the parts from Tiny Tim to Jacob Marley, because it was an opportunity, you know, not to stand at his writing desk because he worked standing up in his own mind, but to see the reaction of people to what he created. And that's a pretty great feeling. So thank you all very much for coming tonight.